Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, September 4th, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. We welcome to our call today our moderator, Jamil Jaffer. He's the former chief counsel and senior advisor of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. We also plan to have on our call today two experts, Professor Alan Dershowitz and Ambassador Dennis Ross. And at this point, let me turn things over to Jamil Jaffer.
Thank you so much, and welcome everybody to the Federal Society's conference call podcast on the Iran deal. What I'll do is let me just talk about the format real quick, and then we'll get started. The format will be, we'll start out, I'll introduce Professor Dershowitz. He'll give about 5 or 6 minutes on his point of view. I'll then introduce Ambassador Ross. He'll give us 5 or 6 minutes on his point of view. And then we'll have them have a conversation. And about halfway through the call, we'll open it up for questions from the audience. And Dean will run that part of it. So if we just go ahead and get started, Professor Alan Dershowitz really needs no introduction, but he is the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law Emeritus at Harvard Law School. He's been called one of the nation's top civil liberties lawyers. There's no doubt that is true. He joined the Harvard Law School faculty at the age of 25, he's been the subject of 2 New Yorker cartoons and has a sandwich at Fenway Park named after him, pastrami, of course. Most importantly, for the purposes of this call, he is the author of a new book, The Case Against the Iran Deal, How Can We Now Stop Iran from Getting Nukes? With that, Professor Dershowitz.
Well, thank you so much for your kind introduction, but I have to add one or two more things to the introduction that are very relevant to our discussion today. And the reason I'm mentioning this is because supporters of the deal have often demonized opponents of the deal, calling them warmongers, saying they're part of a Republican partisan opposition, that they all supported the Iraq war. I am a liberal Democrat who twice voted for Barack Obama for president, who supported Hillary Clinton when she was running against Barack Obama, who was opposed to the Iraq war, and who generally is on the peace side of Israeli politics, yet I'm against the deal. I'm against the deal in part for several reasons. Number one, I don't know what's in the deal. I've read the deal carefully. In my book, I have the deal quoted word for word with all kinds of comments about the deal next to it. And I don't know what the deal says. I don't know how long it's supposed to last for. When the deal was first announced, this is what President Obama said to Thomas Friedman, who supports the deal. Quote, I want to be judged on one thing. And this is Friedman's paraphrase of what the president said. Does the deal prevent Iran from breaking out with a nuclear weapon for the next 10 years? For the next 10 years. Is this a deal that simply prevents or precludes Iran from developing nuclear weapons for 10 years, for 8 and a half years, for 12 years? At another point, the president talked about in 12 or 13 years, they'll be just close to a breakout capacity. And we should know the answer to that question. The deal itself has in its preface, in the prelude to the deal, twice the following sentence. Iran reaffirms that Iran will never under any circumstances, never under any circumstances, seek to develop or obtain nuclear weapons. Is that part of the deal or isn't it? Probably most of the people on this call have never heard of that sentence in the deal because the president doesn't quote it. The Secretary of State doesn't quote it. Is that because they have an understanding with the Iranian leaders that although it's in the deal, it's only hortatory, it's not part of the deal? We just don't know the answer to that question. We don't know if there are any other side agreements. We learned that there was a side agreement with the inspectors. We were told that we would have 24/7 inspection. I certainly understood that as 24 hours, not 24 days. We now learn that under certain circumstances, the inspection can extend to 24 days. There's just absolutely no reason for that. At the very least, there should be a freezing situation where the moment the inspection is sought, everything has to be frozen, everything is locked down, there are seals, there's no opportunity to move anything. Then if they want to challenge for 24 hours, fine, but if the inspectors win, then at least nothing can have been moved for 24 in the 24 days. That's the way it's done in the criminal justice system often when a client has a valise seized and we challenge, then the police hold on to the valise, but they don't open it. And then we litigate it. And then after we lose, if we lose, they can open it. But this 24-hour business, giving them the ability to move things around, if we discover new facilities, and we know that new facilities have been discovered repeatedly, the MEK, a dissident group, helped to discover a new facility just weeks before the United States issued its intelligence assessment saying under the Bush administration that they had given up their nuclear program. I want to talk, because this is the Federalist Society, a bit about process. There's something very undemocratic about the process in this case. The president gets to make a deal by having only one-third plus one of one House of Congress supporting him. The majority of the Senate will oppose this deal. The majority of the House will oppose this deal. Some polls show that the majority of Americans oppose the deal. Some show the opposite. We're just not sure. It depends how the polls are framed. It's very questionable to have a deal of this magnitude supported over the objection of a majority of Congress in the House, the most recently elected members of our government. I think if Hamilton and Madison were here, Madison and Hamilton, the author of Federalist Paper No. 69, they would probably tell you this should be treated as a treaty. And when Senator Kerry was asked why it's not a treaty, he said because we couldn't get it passed if it was. And that's true also if it was perceived to be an executive legislative agreement rather than just an executive agreement. And now the president's threatening the possibility of a filibuster, which wouldn't even permit a debate. There ought to be great Lincoln-Douglas debates about this very, very important foreign policy innovation, and instead debate is being stifled by one of the most undemocratic, anti-democratic procedural tactics developed by Southerners to prevent civil liberties and equality from being given to African Americans, the filibuster. I hope, whatever else happens, that the filibuster is not used to prevent debate about this and that there is a full and complete debate. One more minute, just going forward. This will pass one way or another. Legal challenges will be made, but they probably will not be sustained. I have made a proposal at the end of my book which says that Congress ought to pass a statute reaffirming the prelim to the deal that Iran will never under any circumstances develop nuclear weapons, and authorizing the president now in advance, not only this president but future presidents, to use whatever means are necessary to enforce the entire deal, including that preliminary part of the deal. I think if that were enacted by Congress, that's a deal we could live with. Right now, I think the deal's too risky, which is why the front cover of my book has two dice, one having a symbol of nuclear weapons, the other has a symbol of peace. It's just too risky. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Professor Dershowitz. And now we'll turn to Ambassador Dennis Ross. Ambassador Ross is currently the William Davidson Distinguished Fellow and Counselor at the Washington Institute. There he handles a range of issues and speaks on a variety. Obviously, he has long served as an ambassador overseeing Middle East peace negotiations for over a decade. He served in multiple administrations under multiple presidents of both parties. And most importantly, for my purposes, he's a graduate of UCLA, my alma mater. With that, Ambassador Ross.
Thank you very much. I didn't know we were both Bruins, but glad to hear that. Look, the conclusion that Alan offers is one that converges very much with where I am, even though my public position on the deal is that I'm undecided. I'm undecided not because I think there aren't good elements in the deal. I actually do believe when you go through it all that you can buy 15 years of Iran with no nuclear weapons, and I say that because the whole supply chain, which is the key to having a covert program, will be under 24/7 monitoring, and that's an idea actually that I had when I was in the administration in the first term, that this was an essential part of any deal that was to emerge, and that actually is in the deal, meaning where you mine uranium, where you mill it and turn it into yellow cake, where you take that yellow cake and turn it into hexafluoride UF6, which is a gas, where you take that UF6 gas and you feed it into a centrifuge. Each of the links in that chain are under 24/7 monitoring, which would make it very difficult to be secreting away any of those materials, which is what you'd have to do if you're going to have a covert program, number one. Number two, whereas the Iranians today have 10 bombs worth of material, according to this deal, they're limited to 300 kilograms or less than one bomb's worth for 15 years, which makes it very difficult for them to have an enrichment approach to a bomb. Three, they have to take the core of their heavy water reactor out and fill it with cement. and there's no reprocessing capability that is permitted for 15 years. And those are three different pathways to a bomb for 15 years. Also, the reason I'm undecided is not because I think there's an easy way to produce a better deal in a negotiation. I don't think the other members of the 5+1 are coming back to negotiation. And I think in a circumstance where the Iranians don't look like they're the bad guys, but we are because we blocked it, we'll find it very difficult also to sustain the sanctions regime. So I don't want to be in a situation where the Iranians have 10 bombs worth of material or 2 to 3 months away from breakout, and the sanction regime breaks down. So you might ask the question, so why am I undecided after I outline those two points of view? Well, the reason I'm undecided is because after year 15, there really are no limitations on the kind of program that the Iranians can build up, no limitations on the size of their nuclear infrastructure, no limitations as to whether or not they could actually even produce highly enriched uranium. And I'm worried that after year 15, when Iran effectively, when it comes to the size of its program, is treated as if they're Japan or the Netherlands, when they're not either, I'm worried that after year 15, the gap between threshold status and weapons status will be very small. And if you don't create a firewall today, now, that makes it clear that if we see the Iranians moving towards a weapon at any point, but certainly after year 15, that triggers a use of force, not sanctions, because it's too late for sanctions. And it makes it very clear that the Iranians, they need to know now that they will lose their entire nuclear infrastructure. You need to establish that firewall now because the rest of the world needs to get used to the reality. This is what's going to happen. The Iranians need to be put on notice, but the rest of the world also needs to see it because they become accustomed to it, and it legitimizes the use of force, not the use of sanctions, if we see them moving towards a nuclear weapon. And one of the, when the president wrote his letter to Congressman Nadler, which was designed to address some of the concerns, including some of the concerns I'm raising now, which get to the heart of the need to bolster deterrence, given where the Iranians would be after year 15. There's some very good language in that letter about the president saying he would use whatever means are needed, including military means, to prevent the Iranians from having a nuclear weapon. But the following sentence after he says that refers to, basically says that if the Iranians were to dash towards a weapon, all the options we have available to us today, including military options, would be available to us throughout the Lefkas agreement and beyond. Well, if the Iranians make a decision to dash for a weapon, they've already made a decision to violate the agreement. They've already made a decision to dash towards a weapon. And at that point, if you're really going to deter them, they need to know in advance that that triggers the use of force by us, and there can't be any ambiguity about that. So Alan's, Professor Dershowitz's suggestion that there should be a congressionally mandated authorization of the use of force in that event is something that I would fully subscribe to and goes very far towards addressing one of my major concerns. I actually have a series of five suggestions, which I'll run through, and then I'll pause. Again, to deal with what I see as the main sources of vulnerability with this agreement, you have to bolster deterrence. So the first thing is we need a very blunt declaratory policy along the lines that I mentioned, and I would like to see Congress endorse, and preferably with an authorization of the use of force. Secondly, it needs to be understood that if, in fact, there is, if the Iranians produce highly enriched uranium, for 15 years they are obligated not to enrich above 3.67%. As I said, after year 15, there are no limitations on them whatsoever when it comes to their production. We should make it clear now that that would be a trigger for the use of force because there's no justifiable purpose as it relates to civilian production of nuclear energy that justifies a highly enriched uranium. Thirdly, I would like to transfer to the Israelis the Massive Ordnance Penetrator, which is a mountain buster, not a bunker buster, which would allow the Israelis to be able to take out one of the Iranian nuclear sites that they couldn't today. They don't have a plane that could carry it, so we either have to provide the B-52 or the B-2. But I would like to do this as a way of underpinning our words, to make it clear that what we say we mean when it comes to deterrence, that either on our own with the Israelis or in support of the Israelis, we would make sure that the Iranians can't move towards a nuclear weapon. Providing the MOP to the Israelis underpins those words, but it also sends a message that we mean what we say, and that, in fact, there may be those who question whether or not we'll use force, but very few would question whether the Israelis would, particularly if the Iranians were moving towards a weapon. two more points and I'll stop. I think it's very important to establish a pattern of behavior that shows consistently that we will not tolerate any transgressions by the Iranians of their commitments, no matter how small those transgressions are. The snapback function in the agreement is one that gives us the ability to ensure that if there's a significant violation, since you have to have an affirmative vote to continue the suspension of the sanctions regime, we could veto an affirmative vote and make sure that the sanctions regime snaps back. But we're only going to employ that in the event of a significant violation. And the Iranians are most likely to cheat along the margins, if for no other reason than to test how good the verification is. We're not going to bring the whole agreement down over what would be marginal kinds of violations, and yet those are the kind of violations the Iranians will pursue, partly, as I said, to test the verification regime, and partly also because I think, you know, this allows them to change the baseline. So I think we need to have in advance, and here again I'd like to see the Congress act, I think we should be spelling out what are the kind of smaller penalties for smaller violations as a way of demonstrating the consistency of what our words mean when it comes to if they cheat, there's a consequence. And the last point is this, because any deal with the Iranians, whether even if it was a deal that was much better in terms of rolling back their nuclear infrastructure, they were going to get sanctions relief. Now, the problem, of course, with sanctions relief is it means that if they can cause trouble in the region now when they're under sanctions, imagine how much more trouble they can cause when sanctions relief means that they have significantly more assets available to them. This is one of the things that worries all the Arabs in the region, and obviously it also is one of the worries the Israelis have. I would like now as well something else for the Congress to do. I would like Congress to support the administration, and I say support the administration, by making it clear that we see a surge in material support for Hezbollah or Hamas or the other Shiite militias, that there will be a new set of targeted sanctions to make it clear that there's a price for any destabilizing behavior. And for those who, I think, who worry that somehow when you do these kinds of things, it hurts the, quote, pragmatists within the Iranian regime, I would argue just the opposite. If you want, in fact, to make it clear that what Qasem Soleimani and the Revolutionary Guard are doing throughout the region, that they want to make it clear that it costs Iran, you have to make it clear, you have to be able to show that there's a price for what they're doing. So I would like us to not only have targeted sanctions in response to that kind of behavior, I would also like us to begin now very clearly to engage in contingency planning and developing options to counter them. And that would also be part of a set of messages that would make it clear to the Iranians, if you engage in certain kinds of behaviors, you're going to pay a price for it. It was the sanctions that got them to the table on the nuclear issue. We should be clear that we're going to raise the price to them for their destabilizing behavior in the region. I'll stop there.
Well, thank you, Ambassador Ross. So, Professor Dershowitz, Ambassador Ross has laid out a series of five suggestions to ameliorate the fact that this deal is going to go into effect. And you've laid out similar suggestions in your book. What do you think about the things that, that Ambassador Ross has laid out, and what would you add or take off that list?
Well, first of all, I wish Ambassador Ross had negotiated this deal. I think we would have gotten a far, far, far better deal. I don't think the negotiation was done in as good a fashion as it could have been done. There's almost nothing I disagree with what Dennis Ross said, and that's, by the way, been true over the last, I don't know, 25 or 30 years. I think I would have to really, really search hard to find anything that Ambassador Ross has said or written, including his masterful book, which I disagree with. So this is not going to be a debate. Ambassador Ross says he's undecided. I'm also a bit undecided in the sense if I were a senator or congressman, I'm not absolutely sure how I would vote on this. I am not at all ambivalent about the fact that it's a bad deal. I think it's a bad deal on balance. It's a bad deal. I wish it hadn't been agreed to, but the president may conceivably be right when he says Congress rejecting the deal may cause more harm than Congress accepting the deal. So I guess you can put me in that respect not too far from undecided. I'm not undecided about the nature of the deal. I am somewhat undecided about whether one option is worse than the other. I'm also not undecided about the fact that when the president and the secretary of state give us two options, one of which is very bad and the other one is even worse, that that's not the options that the American public ought to be exposed to. The only thing I would add, and it's really minor, Ambassador Ross said that it's very important for the world, the P5+1, particularly to know that we are prepared to use the military option if Iran ever, under any circumstances, breaks out toward a nuclear weapon. I think the most important recipients of that information, however, are both the Iranian regime and the Israelis. What frightens me most about this deal is it makes it, I think, in some ways more likely that Israel will feel at some point in the future that it has no choice but to unilaterally try to attack the Iranian nuclear facilities. And I think this deal makes it harder for Israel to do that, both militarily and diplomatically and politically. And my hope, of course, is that Israel never has to employ that option. But both the ambassador and I know Benjamin Netanyahu well. I've known him since 1973. And I am absolutely certain that if he were told by his unanimous intelligence people that Iran is on the verge of a breakout to nuclear weapons and the only way to stop them is a risky, risky military attack, that cautious as he has been, I think he would authorize that military attack. And I think part of the goal is to make it less likely that Israel will be forced to do that. So I completely agree with the mountain-busting bombs. I agree also that the president ought to say, and the Congress ought to say, that there is authorization for military use, and it will be used if Iran seeks to develop nuclear weapons, and that as far as the American policy is concerned, this is a forever deal, not a 10-year deal, not a 15-year deal. It's a 15-year deal on all of the elements that the ambassador set out, but it's a forever deal on precluding Iran from doing the game-changing act, to quote the president, of developing nuclear weapons. And I think if that were all done, then again, it's a deal that I think might, in the end, produce more good than harm. It will always be risky. I mean, just to mention a couple of other elements, the president and others have said this is more likely to result in regime change because it will empower moderates. It's also very likely to give the Iranians regime more money to repress dissent and to make sure that the current regime stays in power if they improve slightly the economic condition of the people. So there's a lot of speculation here. And you know, those of us who are cautious about foreign policy are always reluctant to sign off on deals that have unpredictable speculation. Having said that, almost all foreign policy decisions have speculative elements. This one, I think we've been sold by the president more certainty than this deal has. And so I think Ambassador Ross's conclusion of uncertain is probably the most honest position that anybody can take. I think those who think this is a great, wonderful deal are overstating it. Those who think this is the end of the world are overstating it. And I think both the ambassador and I are somewhat in the middle. I may be more toward the negative. He may be more toward reluctant positive, but we're in the same ballpark and probably sitting in the same section, although he may be rooting for the Bruins and, you know, I may be rooting for Harvard, but that's where we separate.
Right.
Well, thanks, Professor Dershowitz. I think you can count me safely in the against the deal, and would recommend the members of Congress they vote against it. But Ambassador Ross, I want to raise something that Professor Dershowitz has raised. So, you know, let's say you were, and this may be unfair, but if you were advising the Israeli Prime Minister today, knowing that the reality is this administration will not provide the Israelis the MOP, or certainly not the delivery capabilities, the B-2 or the B-52, to deliver it. And it's highly unlikely that they will publicly announce support for a congressional AUMF to pre-authorize use of force, although that may be a little closer. If you were advising the Israeli Prime Minister in light of that, what he should be saying or doing today, what would you recommend then? And also, what would you recommend on the day that Iran decided to break out and Israel doesn't have the MOP? It doesn't have a clear indication from the U.S. that it would use force. What would you recommend that the Israeli Prime Minister in that circumstance?
Well, let's break this down into different parts. Part one, is that I think the key here for the Israeli prime minister is now that it's clear that this is not going to be blocked, now the prime minister, I think, needs to focus on what can he do to gain certain either commitments or material support from the United States that can help put Israel in a stronger position as it relates to the consequences of this deal. The first thing I would suggest to the prime minister is that he raise with the president the idea of having a joint implementation committee between the United States and Israel. We did this when I was in the administration in the first year. One of the things that we did is I went to the Israelis and others, and we created a discussion where we raised the idea of, look, you guys, you Israel, follow very closely the sanctions regime and the possible loopholes in it. Tell us what we can do to close those loopholes and tell us which sanctions you think have the biggest effect on the Iranians. I'd like to create the equivalent of that now, where the Israelis, nobody has a stronger incentive to be vigilant about the implementation of this deal, actually, than the Israelis do. Even if they were against it, now they have to live with the consequences of it. So having a joint U.S.-Israeli committee to watch what's going on, we already have very close intelligence cooperation, focus very heavily on what is going on in terms of the possibility of any kinds of Iranian moves, including their moves along the margin, and have a discussion with the Israelis on what to do in the event of that. I think that would be helpful and also reassuring to the Israelis, and it would also, I think, push the administration in a direction where they really do have to keep the Iranian feet to the fire, and they can keep the other members of the 5+1, certainly the Europeans, informed of what's going on in the U.S.-Israeli discussion. So I would suggest that, number one. Number two, I wouldn't give up on the idea that the MOP is something that it can't be provided to the Israelis. You know, one of the things we could be pushing the Congress to do, and if I were, you know, I think that this is something that the Israelis obviously could be raising, both with the administration and with the Congress, is that something that could be put in an authorization bill? And when it comes to the B-2, you could even think about deployments of the B-2 to Israel. You could think about a permanent loan. You could think about even American deployments of the B-2 to Israel. That would send an interesting kind of signal. Same with the MOP, even if it's not turned over right away. I'd still like to see a commitment to it, but even, you know, it could be forward deployed in Israel. There's a lot of things that could be done that could send signals that we are with Israel, number one, and sending a signal to the Iranians that they wouldn't miss, number two. And what Alan was saying earlier about the most important audience for this message, that if you make a move towards a weapon, the most important audiences are the Iranians, first and foremost, and secondarily, the Israelis. And also this point that he made about this is a forever deal. When it comes to the issue of nuclear weapons, this is a forever deal, not a 15-year deal. It's a forever deal. And so, and I think that having the prime minister say to the president, you know, how about you write me a letter? Not just the letters you've done to Congressman Nadler and to Senator Coons. How about, you know, you write me a letter that makes it clear that this is a forever deal when it comes to the U.S. commitment to preventing Iran from having nuclear weapons. I think that would be highly useful. The last point I would make, I would have the prime minister suggest to the president, and in a sense, quote the president back to the president. The president basically is saying, all right, this is going to buy us the 15 years. So what do we do with those 15 years? If you buy 15 years, how do you take advantage of it? What can the U.S. and Israel be doing together? What might the U.S. be doing with its other partners in the region? And this can also be a part of a discussion with the Israelis, since the truth is, today, the level of Israeli cooperation, quiet cooperation with a wide range of different Arab leaders and Arab states is much more extensive than we've seen in the past, precisely because there's a perception of common strategic threat, largely coming from Iran, but not exclusively. And I would focus very heavily on, all right, what is it we can do in these next 15 years to put ourselves in a better position, to compete more effectively with Iran, to enhance deterrence so the Iranians don't even think about moving towards a weapon. I would deal with that. Now, as for the issue of, you know, what happens if we see them dashing, you know, look, at that point, if Israel sees Iran dashing, they're going to act. What Alan said is exactly right. And by the way, it doesn't matter who the Israeli prime minister is. This is, you know, Iran, you have the supreme leader of Iran, you have the head of the Revolutionary Guard, Jafari. they're consistently talking. Again, look at what they're saying in the last, yesterday and the last couple of weeks. They're consistently talking about the destruction of Israel, the elimination of Israel. No Israeli prime minister is going to take lightly these words, not only because they're not just rhetorical, but the fact is Iran is constantly acting in a way that is designed to build threats and pressures, terrorist threats and pressures against Israel. So what Iran says, you have to take seriously, and any Israeli prime minister would do so. If the U.S. isn't going to act, the Israelis are certain to in the circumstance where the Iranians are dashing towards a weapon.
Great. Thank you, Ambassador Ross. So I think we're now at about the halfway point of the call. Professor Dershowitz, if you don't have anything to immediately add, we'll turn to questions. Do you have anything you'd like to add at this point?
I'm perfectly happy to turn to questions. Let's find out what the audience members think.
Sure. Perfect. Dean?
Thank you all. In a moment, we'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either or even both of our speakers, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our speakers, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me make a quick announcement before we turn to our callers. Next Wednesday, at the 9th of September at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be talking about empty suit litigation in our next scheduled teleform call. Then on Thursday at 12:30, we'll be debating birthright citizenship. It's quite possible we'll add a call on Tuesday, so do check the website for updates. Today, of course, we're speaking with Jamil Jaffer, Professor Alan Dershowitz, and Ambassador Dennis Ross, and taking your questions. We've got three questions in the queue right now, so let's go to our first caller.
Question to Avi. What do you make of the readings in the agreement that, in a sense, cautions Israel that if they attacked, America would be obligated to help defend Iran?
Mm-hmm. Okay, good question. This is obviously somebody who knows me as a young man because I was brought up with the name Avi and adopted the name Alan when my mother said, you're going to college, you need a real name. So thank you, whoever the caller is, for reminding me of my roots. It's a misreading of the deal that has been put out by people who have been strongly opposed to the deal. In one of the appendices to the deal, there's a very generic statement saying that the P5 plus one will assist the Iranians in protecting their nuclear civilian program from sabotage or espionage. There's absolutely nothing in the deal, and Ambassador, correct me if I over or understate it, nothing in the deal that obligates the United States to in any way take military action against Israel if Israel were to attack the Iranian nuclear reactor. That is not something that I think a president would put in a deal, and not something that the American public would ever accept. Ambassador, is my reading correct?
100%. And the administration, people I've talked to in the administration have made it very clear that there is no obligation on our part to be protecting the Iranians.
Yeah, I think it was a foolish thing to put it in the appendix. It just was too provocative, and there was no reason for it. But it's there, and it means what it means.
All right, we've got two questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got about 25 minutes remaining in our call and time for more questions. Let's now turn to another caller.
Thank you, Professor Dershowitz and Ambassador Ross. I think it's been a very important discussion and a lot of common sense proposals from both of you. My concern is that the legislation that has been proposed in this discussion seems to be based on the assumption that these negotiations were just something that went awry, that there was just a failure on our part to push our advantage and push our side hard enough. My concern is that I think the negotiations ended up exactly or almost exactly where the administration wanted them to go, in which case I don't see any prospect that this administration will actually sign on to any kind of legislation of the type being discussed today. Is there something wrong with my logic, or is there some way to address that?
Well, I'm happy to start and take that. I think the president would be very hard-pressed to oppose legislation which simply reiterated what is already in the deal, namely Iran's reaffirmation that it will never seek to obtain nuclear weapons. And I think the president would be hard-pressed also to veto or to criticize a deal that basically authorizes him and future presidents to make the decision whether to use a military option. It's not mandating that he employ the military option. It's simply authorizing. In fact, when I used to teach constitutional issues, I always had a hypothetical in my class. What would happen if the Congress of the United States, which only the Congress can do, were to declare war on a country and the president were to refuse to fight it? I think the framers of the Constitution never thought about that. Congress, I don't think, can mandate a president to fight a war, but they can authorize a president to take military action, and that's all I am proposing, and I think that's all that Ambassador Ross is proposing. I think it would be much harder for the president to veto such legislation than it is for him, which he's now going to do, obviously, to veto this, which is an up and down, down vote on the deal itself.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I look, you the peg is exactly what Professor Dershowitz said. The Iranians make the commitment in the deal not to seek, acquire, or pursue nuclear weapons. If they violate that, you know, and by the way, there's no term limit on it. They don't say it's for the life of this deal. They simply say it. They're, you know, this is a commitment they're making.
Mm-hmm.
We should be saying we're going to hold them to that commitment.
Right.
If we see them violate that commitment during the life of this deal or at any point, that, you know, that should, I mean, I would love to see such legislation. I'd love to see some of the Democrats who, in fact, are supporting the agreement propose such legislation, and here would be a good opportunity for bipartisan support.
Can I add just to that that I have spoken to several senators who have made a proposal that actually involves the two of us, Ambassador, and that is some senators have said to me that, and these are senators who are going to vote for the deal, have said they would look very kindly on a group of professionals, such as, and your name always comes up, Ambassador Ross, and others, who would propose such a middle ground as a group. Coming from professionals rather than politicians, it would make it easier for them to propose and enact such legislation. So after this call is over, Ambassador, if you and I wanted to talk offline and see if we could head up a group of people who both oppose, support, and are uncertain about the deal, are urging Congress to, when they enact the deal one way or another, legislate in accordance with what we tend to agree to. I think that could be very helpful to senators who would like some academic and professional background before they introduce the legislation.
I would be all for that. I mean, I think it would be great. I think it would be very important when there is a convergence of interests. This has become a partisan issue for sure. But there's no disagreement that Iran shouldn't be allowed ever to have a nuclear weapon. That is neither a Republican or a Democratic position. That is an American position. And I would love to see that embodied in legislation. And I would love to use, as I said, the hook in the agreement where the Iranians make a commitment.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm all for that.
Good.
Sounds like we might be making some news here today. We've got three.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Three questions pending, so let's carry on with another caller now.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for these remarks. Appreciate the common sense perspective. It's kind of amazing the lack of that, I guess, in much of the process, it seems, thus far. My question has to do with why did Congress agree to shift the voting burden from two-thirds to approve to now two-thirds or more required to disapprove and give the advantage to the administration on the issues that we're discussing in that regard? They seem to concede their leverage, and in particular, why would Republicans do that? I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, look, I think one thing is that the administration initially had no intention of going to the Congress at all. said it wasn't a treaty. In some ways, it said it wasn't even an executive agreement. It was an understanding, and that the that in a sense the congressional issues and prerogatives wouldn't become operative until Congress was being asked to rescind or revoke legislatively mandated sanctions. And according to the agreement, the sanctions are suspended for 8 years and not terminated. So the argument was there was no need to go to the Congress at all. It was Republicans and Democrats alike who said, look, you can't negotiate whatever you call it, this understanding, and not have any kind of congressional review. So this produced what was the Corker-Cardin resolution, which became legislation embodied by both houses, which in effect put Congress in a position where for 30 days, if this understanding had been negotiated prior to July 9th, and 60 days, if it came after July 9th, Congress would be in a position where it had 60 days then to approve, disapprove, or do nothing. And so that's what evolved and how it evolved.
There's one interesting thing. Professor Nathan Lewin, who Ambassador and I know very well, who's a brilliant constitutional scholar, has written an article making the case that this kind of legislation, he doesn't use the term legislation, this kind of congressional action should not be subject to the constitutional presidential power of a veto. And he cites debates from Madison and others. You know, it's an interesting argument. It's also an interesting argument that Hamilton would have seen this as a treaty, but I think the political question doctrine would preclude courts from getting into this debate. I think this is a controversy that really has to be resolved between the executive and the legislature, though I know that there are some people who are considering bringing legal action to try to either prevent the president from exercising his veto power or to say that the Corker bill is unconstitutional because it abdicates the Senate's power to vote on a treaty by a two-thirds majority. I think for purposes of going forward, we have to assume this deal is going into effect, and there'll be some side play along the way, but I think, you know, Oliver Wendell Holmes once said the job of a lawyer is to predict what the courts will do in fact, and as a lawyer, I'm predicting that the courts will not enter into this dispute and jump into this political thicket. So I think we have to, in moving forward, assume that the deal will be implemented.
I think that's exactly right.
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, it's Jamil Jaffer. I think that's exactly right. And just to provide a little more color, since I was at the former Legislative Committee working for Senator Corker when this bill came about, the situation that Congress found itself confronted with at the time the president announced the deal was exactly as Professor Dershowitz and Ambassador Ross have laid out, which is the president said, look, I'm not coming to Congress. I'm going to implement this deal no matter what once it's made. And by the way, you've given me statutory authority to waive sanctions under this broad national security waiver, and I'm going to use that statutory authority to its full limit, and I'm going to go ahead and implement this deal. And there were simply not the votes in Congress to take away his statutory waiver authority, which we would have preferred to do, or to use the appropriations power to force the president to submit this as a treaty. Given that, the options that Congress is confronted with in a very real sense where let the president implement the deal using a statutory authority and not come to us at all, or try to get a bipartisan majority to force him to submit the deal to Congress and to put his statutory authority to engage in waivers on hold for a limited time so this very conversation and this very vote could take place without the deal already being moving forward. And so that was exactly what Congress is confronted with and why they, I think, made this choice.
Any consideration at that point that there might be a filibuster, or has that really come out of the blue?
No, in fact, the filibuster was very much part of the conversation, and what Democrats told Republicans, at least as part of the negotiations, was that we will not accept a non-filibusterable resolution. We won't support it. We won't vote for it. You won't get bipartisan support. And given that, knowing that we'd face presidential veto, which he threatened to veto the Corker-Cardin legislation, even as it had bipartisan support, in order to get past a veto, to get a veto-proof majority on that legislation, we had to concede the filibuster question. Now, I agree with you, Professor Dershowitz. It is cowardly and would be quite disturbing if Congress were to filibuster this. It's the right thing to do is take a merits vote on this and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
We've still got three.
I'm sorry, we still got three questions pending in about 12 minutes, so let's try and get to as many as possible. I did want to mention Ambassador Dennis Ross has a book coming out, Doomed to Succeed, on U.S.-Israel relationship, Truman to Obama. That's coming out in mid-October.
Can't wait to read it.
And, of course, Professor Dershowitz's book.
Can't wait to talk about it.
Professor Dershowitz's book.
I mean, it's good.
Professor Dershowitz's book, again, is Case Against the Iran Deal. It's number two in World Politics and Foreign Relations on Amazon as we speak. So let's continue on with our questions.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. The last caller actually took my first question about whether or not Congress could try to convert this to a treaty vote now. But so let me turn to the second point is there any way that Congress can, while there's going to be the lifting of the sanctions, add additional legislation to slow down the release of the funds such that they don't get the $150 billion right away and instead it is parsed out over the length of the deal or some other type of constraints?
I really don't see how Congress can do that because the deal basically says that Iran will get sanctions relief once it has fulfilled its major nuclear obligations in the understanding in the JCPOA. It'll take roughly 6 months for them to do that. They have to, just to give you an example of what it is they have to do, they have to go from, they have close to 12,000 kilograms of low-enriched uranium right now. They have to reduce that to 300. They won't be able to reduce that quickly unless they simply ship it all out, and even that takes a little bit of time if they ship it out, number one. Number two, they have to reduce the number of operating centrifuges from 9,500, which are operating now, to 5,060. They're permitted 6,000, but 5,060 that are operating, they currently have 19,500. The difference between 6,000, which they're permitted to have, and the 19,500, that 13,500 have to be put in storage. They have to take the core of the heavy water reactor at Iraq out and fill it with cement. They have to set up what is the verification regime for the whole supply chain. And when you look at what I've just described, it's probably pretty hard for them to carry out this set of obligations in less than about 6 months' time. But once they've done that, according to the agreement, then sanctions at that point get lifted. It's worth noting, by the way, that there is a separate paragraph in the agreement where the EU commits on behalf of the EU, separate, not related to the United States or anything we're doing, where the EU commits to lifting all of its sanctions once those major nuclear obligations are done. And I would just remind you that it was the EU sanctions that were the turning point, because when the EU made the decision to stop buying Iranian oil, that's what had the most significant impact on the Iranian economy. It's not the sole thing, because they were cut off from international financial institutions. They couldn't do normal commercial business. They couldn't get insurance for their shipping. They couldn't carry out commercial transactions. But the key turning point in all this were the EU sanctions, in particular when they made the decision not to buy Iranian oil. So in this agreement, there is a separate paragraph where the EU, not related to anything except the Iranian fulfillment of their major nuclear obligations, which I just outlined, commits to lift all the EU sanctions at that point, and that'll be roughly 6 months into the deal.
What do you think the president would do if Congress enacted a new sanction unrelated to the nuclear program, saying that if any money is sent to Hezbollah, particularly because they're the greater danger than Hamas, but Hezbollah, for purchases of additional rockets, because they have very sophisticated rockets now into the heart of Israel, that additional sanctions would be imposed unrelated to the nuclear sanctions?
I believe that he would go along with that. If you look at what the commitments he's making in both the Nadler letter and especially the Kunz letter, he certainly is leaning towards that. And Adam Zubin, who is the person who presides over the sanctions, has been very clear that both all the any sanctions related to terror, any sanctions related to human rights, will be enforced to the fullest. And if we see them doing things that along lines of what you said, that certainly fits a category that they would support. Now, I think such a resolution, such legislation, I think they'd be, again, to use your words, Alan, I think the president would be very hard-pressed not to support that, given what he's been saying.
Mm-hmm. So isn't that a good other step for Congress to think about taking? I think Congress should now be sitting and planning a whole legislative program based on the acceptance of this deal, passing legislation that would get bipartisan support and which the president would be very, very hard-pressed to veto or even oppose.
I agree.
We've got about 8 minutes left, two questions pending. I'd like to get to both of them if at all possible, so I'm asking the callers to be as concise as possible in their questions.
Hi. My question is, do you feel that this deal and kind of the process and procedure of its most assuredly eventual implementation will lead to a paradigm shift in terms of the president's treaty powers versus the presidential legislative agreement, or how do you think this interplay is going to work out in the long term for American foreign policy?
Who wants to take a first shot at that one?
Oh, I think that's Dennis's question. He's
the
reigning expert on foreign policy broad issues.
Yeah, I don't know what kind of a precedent this is going to establish. I suspect that certainly as it relates to negotiating foreign agreements, you know, I think that subsequent administrations will find Congress is going to look for new ways to insist that if there's, you know, that these kinds of agreements, either they fall under the rubric of a treaty or fall under the rubric of an executive agreement, either way, Congress really needs to have more than just a review posture on these kinds of issues. I mean, a year ago, I wrote an article where I actually favored the idea that the administration should be working with the Congress with an eye towards getting congressional endorsement of this. That would have been much preferable. It wouldn't have turned this into what has become a highly partisan issue. Iran shouldn't be a highly partisan issue. Most foreign policy, national security issues shouldn't be highly partisan issues. Maybe it's true we're in an unusually partisan climate, but I do hope that one of the consequences of this will be not to take away the prerogatives of a president to conduct foreign policy and to conduct national security policy, but when you're going to reach agreements with foreign powers, I certainly wouldn't want to see Congress's role in this process somehow emasculated to the point where, in effect, it really, you know, you can end up in a situation where one third in each chamber is enough to get through what is something that's highly controversial. So I hope that in the future we'll see some adjustment.
Time for a final question. I'm sorry, Professor Dershowitz, were you going to weigh in there?
Well, I completely agree.
Okay, let's take our final question.
Hello. Yeah, I was wondering, why should anyone in the Israeli public or the Israeli government have trust for the U.S. administration with the history of idiotic American diplomacy going back to the INF Treaty with the Soviets, where it turned out they were hiding 73 SS-23 missiles under Eastern Europe, and which would have been devastating if there had been a war at that time, to the latest mess with North Korea, allowing a leader of the quality of Kim Jong-un to have nuclear weapons, and the accomplishments of American diplomacy. Why should there be any confidence in Israel that any American administration would come out with a policy that would bring a result any different from those agreements? And to add to it, if Israel feels it has to act unilaterally and act alone in its defense, and Obama decides to implement the Brzezinski policy of militarily stopping Israel, do you think Israel should not act based on an American military threat? And also, if Israel does act to protect itself and America mm-hmm. does intervene, as some in the U.S. National security establishment think that it should, whose side will you be on?
Well, you know, that's a very complicated question. First of all, I think America's policy toward Israel in general has been very positive. The Obama administration's policy has been very positive in terms of exchange of intelligence, exchange of military. So I think one should not paint this black and white. American diplomacy obviously has a mixed record. The Brzezinski plan is dead on arrival. Nobody is going to adopt the Brzezinski plan. Nobody is going to be shooting down Israeli planes that are seeking to defend its people. I don't think that's particularly realistic. I do think that the American administration may very well advise Israel not to take military action. That's what they did when Ehud Olmert made the decision to destroy the Syrian nuclear reactor. He did it over the strong objection of President Bush. And when Israel destroyed the Osirik nuclear reactor, not only over the strong objection of President Reagan, who was as strong a supporter of Israel as anybody, but resulted in a condemnation of Israel at the United Nations with a vote cast by the United States to condemn Israel. Of course, years later, the United States government thanked Israel for making it possible for them to go into Kuwait and rescue the Kuwaitis, something that probably would have been much more difficult to do if Iraq had developed nuclear weapons. So I think it's more complicated than you set it out. As far as trust is concerned, let me just end with my quote from one of my dear friends, Elie Wiesel, who once said that for him the lesson of the Holocaust is always believe the threats of your enemies more than the promises of your friends. And I think this situation bears that out. As the ambassador said, we have to take very seriously the threats of Iran. We have to assume that they mean it when they say it. And as far as the promises of America are concerned, you know, they're very important to Israel. But Israel, in the end, is a sovereign nation that has to make its own decisions. Just like America would never outsource the defense of its people to a foreign country, Israel can never outsource the defense of its people to a foreign country. One hopes it doesn't come to that, that this deal will keep the status quo for 15 years, and that perhaps after that there will be other ways of assuring that Iran will never develop nuclear weapons. I think it's very clear, it should be clear to the Iranians and to the Americans, that Israel would do whatever it has to do to prevent that from happening, whether it's a year from now or 15 years from now. One hopes that that won't have to happen, but Israel is not going to outsource its defense to America or anyone else.
Yeah, I would just say, look, I would recommend to the questioner my book called Doomed to Succeed, the U.S.-Israeli Relationship from Truman to Obama. I do a chapter on every administration, every president, and the national security apparatus. And you'll see the evolution of that relationship. You'll also see how the U.S. is Israel's only friend in the world. So the idea that somehow you want to come in and sort of say, don't trust American diplomacy, well, most Israelis actually put a premium on American diplomacy. They're constantly asking for America's help. It doesn't mean America always gets it right, and it doesn't mean that Israel is going to ever give up the right of being able to defend itself. In fact, one of the issues that has repeatedly at times created tensions, but in every case after the tension has emerged, you've seen a mending of the fences and a stronger convergence of interests, has been over Israel's unilateral use of force. What Professor Dershowitz was referring to when Israel bombed the Osirik reactor, it's not only that we condemned it, it's not only we acted at the UN, President Reagan suspended the shipment of F-16s to Israel. We've seen on a number of different occasions that there has been an American response to these things. It is inconceivable that we would militarily try to stop the Israelis. I don't see that in the cards. Brzezinski is completely out of step with what, in fact, is the basic view of Israel in this country and has been the basic view over time. And, you know, the bottom line is that whatever our differences are now, if the past is prologue, you'll find that we end up emerging in a relationship that is even stronger. The title of the book is called Doomed to Succeed. It's not called Doomed to Succeed? And there's a reason why I come to that conclusion.
Well, thank you both, gentlemen. Jamil Jaffer, a final thought before we adjourn?
Well, look, I think these are very difficult issues, and obviously the administration has made the deal they've made, and Congress will vote on it here in the near future. We'll see what happens. I think that the predictions that have been made here today are accurate in the sense that it does appear that Congress does not have the votes to override a veto. I do think Professor Dershowitz is right that it would be better if Congress did not filibuster this and instead allowed it to go to a merits vote and let the president make his decision. But we'll see what happens. At the very least, we've got some great ideas and what appears to be a budding bipartisan consensus on things that Congress could do to address the challenges with this deal. And I'm excited to hear the news that Professor Dershowitz and Ambassador Ross are going to work together on this. I'd love to be part of that effort. And with that, it looks like the Federalist Society bringing people of diverse minds together to make things happen.
This is Dean Reuter. Let me thank Jamil Jaffer for playing the role of moderator today. Thanks to Ambassador Dennis Ross. He's also the author of Doomed to Succeed. And thanks, of course, to Professor Alan Dershowitz, author of Case Against the Iran Deal. To our audience, thank you for joining us. Thank you for your thoughtful questions. Our next scheduled Teleform conference call, Wednesday, September 9th, next week, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll talk about empty suit litigation. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.